Well, now it is my pleasure to introduce Professor Martin Bohus, who is, well, actually, it's interesting because I think probably some of you, I'm sure all of you are familiar with his work, but many of you maybe never have seen Martin before. But Martin is really an icon in BPD research and treatment development and treatment delivery in the world. He runs a fantastic lab and has for, what, 20 years or something like that, a long time, which is very unique in the sense that he's looking at very basic processes, psychophysiological processes, physiological processes, as well as psychotherapy processes. He's the first, if I'm right about this, I think he's the first chair who's a behavior therapist in Germany. All previous chairs in psychiatry have been psychoanalysts. So that's quite an accomplishment, and I'm sure we can only imagine what that might be like. So anyway, he is the chair of psychosomatic medicine and psychotherapy at the University of Heidelberg and the director of the Clinic of Psychosomatic Medicine at the Central Institute of Mental Health, which in Germany is the parallel to our National Institute of Mental Health. So he's running the show there, and he and his colleagues have really provided us with some of the most interesting, provocative, and innovative methods and data around for BPD. So it's really a pleasure to introduce you, Dr. Martin Bohus.
Okay, thank you, Alan. Good morning. I highly appreciate you getting up that early on Sunday. For me, it's better. It's in the afternoon or something like that. So, my topic is to present data, ideas, and a little bit techniques, how we do, if we apply DBT to patients suffering from PTSD after childhood sexual abuse. Whenever, and this is a strong school of Marshall's, whenever you start to develop a new treatment, the first question you have to ask yourself is that really needed? And since treatment developing on the one thing is really challenging, but on the other thing it's a much fun, and for a lot of young, enthusiastic, ambitious people, they go for and say, okay, I developed my new treatment, I can do workshops and make a little bit of money and stuff like that. But what's currently running is that we are totally overwhelmed with new treatments every month. And I think it's some kind of a responsibility to the field to really focus on that, what's needed. So if you look at childhood sexual abuse, I think most of you are aware that it affects around about 10% of the females and 6% of the male population. This is more or less the data if you look at the whole meta-analysis. 10 up to 12%. And if you look at the sequela of childhood sexual abuse, everybody of you would say, okay, it's PTSD, but that's wrong. It's intuitive, but it's not the only and it's not the most often sequel. So more general are anxiety disorders, depressive disorders, eating disorders, substance abuse, PTBS is clear. PTSD, that's German, sorry. Then sleep disorder is the most common problem. Suicide attempts, more around double as often as PTSD. Then BPD. And then if you look a little bit more on the subthreshold features, then you send a lot of dissociative features, low self-esteem, and what's important, somatic disorders. There are recent data that cardiac problems and so are strongly related to childhood sexual abuse, and this may be due to the HPA axis, and this may be due to metallization problems and stuff like that, but this is an ongoing new research field, and I think we didn't have it in the scope as long, since we only focused on psychiatric problems. And if you look at all that, you can say, okay, this is a bunch of axis 1 and 2 disorders, but usually it's more or less arranged like this. So most of those have more or less the same patterns of this. This means those who have PTSD also suffer from eating disorders, a little bit substance abuse, suicide attempts, sleep disorders, anxiety disorders, depression, and so on. So if you only look at one of those axis 1 disorders, you miss the field. And if we look at the vice versa, the other way around, you see that PPD plays a role here. And we look at our borderline patients. And this is what Melanie Hart will do in the next presentation in details. And then you can estimate that the prevalence of PTSD in our PPD sample is in treatment-seeking patients in Germany. What is inpatients is a little bit different than in the States. We have a very good, let's say, residential treatment possibilities. So it's not like emergency wards, but only. But we have a whole field of what we call centers of excellence there, and people can go there. And insurance pays for, let's say, up to 3 to 4 months for these residential treatments. Yeah, we have good data that it takes that it's worth to do that. So for that, you take it in mind. It's always complicated to report about this in the States, since they can't imagine that that happened. But anyway, the Cornell. I learned my treatment at Cornell. There was the very first DBT unit there. And those times when I learned this was 1996. They also had the possibility to treat for 3 months. And the Kernberg unit, also in Cornell, they had an average inpatient time of 9 months or something like that. So in the outpatient samples, it's in the States more or less the same, let's say 60% more or less. Yeah? In the community sample, not treatment-seeking patients, it's around about 35%. So those who are interested for us, where we say, okay, we are confronted with those problems, let's say 50 to 60% of our patients suffer from co-occurring PTSD. This takes no wonder. If you look at our data, we have a quite large sample now of borderline patients which consecutively have been diagnosed and very carefully investigated with biographic interviews. This is a representative sample of 285 patients, and about 60% of those report sexual abuse during childhood. 40% physical abuse, and then with been witnessing violence between the parents, about 35%. And as you see, those who are victims of sexual abuse, most of them are also have problems with physical abuse and witnessing parental violence. This means this is not an exclusive problem, but it's the whole system is unpredictable and a lot of violence in that. But as it's important, we are talking here in the family environment, 24% don't report one of those major three problems. So you simply cannot say that BPD is the consequence of complex PTSD or something like that. That's wrong, simply wrong. Data don't support that. But on the other hand, 60% have the problem. And if you look at the established psychosocial treatments, there are 5 meta-analyses on the psychosocial treatments on childhood sexual abuse. And the best one is recently published by Taylor and Harvey in 2010. The average effect size is around 0.7, which is about the half of the effect size of Bradley's meta-analysis, which showed that if you look at every PTSD treatment, including type 1 trauma, this means accidents or war traumas or something like that, that's much easier to treat. You have effect sizes of about 1.4 in the average. And so we have only 5, and we have only 6 RCTs. And those 6 RCTs are mainly focusing on 2 treatments. So this means we have, okay. And if you look in details on the 6 RCTs, then the first has been published in 1997. This is Kills Group. And I listed up, do we have some kind of a pointer or so? That would help a bit. The exclusion criteria. So Slotnick et al., who was the very first, she excluded everybody who had some kind of substance abuse and severe dissociation. And The only thing she did not intend to treat, but completer analysis is what they did in those times, and the effect size is but in 0.7. The first study by Cloydre, she excluded eating disorders, substance abuse, severe dissociation, borderlines, suicide attempts, and the history. The median CAPS is the measurement is 69. I reported since ours is much higher afterwards. Thank you very much. And also completer analysis with quite a nice effect size, but she included half of the population. And Chart, who used Patty Resnick's cognitive processing therapy, she excused substance abuse, suicidality, and had a medium CAPS. Nice effect size. McDonough had, it is an exposure-based treatment plus problem-solving, any suicide attempt in the history, any substance abuse, exclusion. Resnick also excluded in her cognitive processing therapy suicidality, I think within the last year. And the only exception is Cloydre, who did not exclude borderline patients. She had about 25%, but she did not report data on this group. So we are not sure whether this group does better or not, so nobody knows what happens with that group. So that's the point. So this means if you look at that group and you say, okay, if you're only focusing on PTSD and excluding the rest, you miss the game. And this is what currently has been done. So this is the situation. What is sitting there? Okay, this is our client, and our client can be defined. So if we are focusing on the group, this means PTSD plus severe emotional dysregulation plus dysfunctional behaviors to cope with this severe emotional dysregulation, which is eating disorders, substance abuse, OCD, and so on. There's currently no efficient treatment. And so what we really do need is a treatment that is focusing on the one hand on traumatic experience, and the other hand is including or not excluding highly dissociative features, suicidality, self-harm, substance abuse, eating disorders, and which can treat people or patients with a symptomatology which is rather high. We looked at our borderline patients with the comorbid PTSD, and the average was a CAPS of 90. And any other treatment currently published, it lies about 60. So this means, yeah? CAPS is the clinically administered PTSD scale. This is the standard observer-rated instrument to assess the frequency and intensity of symptoms regarded to or related to PTSD. This is the standard. It's like the BDI or something in depression. So this is where DBT comes in the field, in the game, and said, okay, why not to use simply DBT? And this is data from Melanie Harnd. I'm sure she will report afterwards in more detail. This is just to give the first thing. She published a very nice, published in the Journal of Consulting and JCC, where she looked at the remission rates in DBT on PTSD if you don't target PTSD. This does not mean, okay, this is what Marsha telling every time, is that DBT treats every good behavioral cognitive treatment is more or less effective in those items which is targeting. And DBT does not target PTSD. We have remission rates within the first year of treatment around 13% in PTSD. This is not sufficient. Okay, so if we now look, what we do need, then we have the first problem is that the standard PTSD treatments, we went very detailed into all these manuals, and mainly what they're focusing is fear and threat. Maybe you're familiar with Ebner Fohr's exposure-based therapy. She only had the whole theory is based on the fear and threat network, and nobody's focusing on emotions like guilt, shame, disgust, self-contempt. This is where DBT comes into the play. Since DBT definitely includes and focuses dysfunctional emotion or non-justified emotions or emotion regulation. If you have problems with guilt, shame, disgust, self-contempt. So the first challenge is that we have to focus this emotion, and we need protocols how to focus them and when to focus them. The second problem, standard PTSD treatment show, is how to handle intense tensions and severe dissociative symptoms. These are data from our labs, and Uli Ebner Prima, who has also been in Seattle sometimes, cooperating with Marshall's lab here, has done that work. This is an assessment on the daily life conditions. So we gave them small, little, tiny handheld computers that beep, let's say, every 20 minutes or every 5 minutes, whatever you say them, and ask, please tell me how strong is your distress currently. We call it aversive tension, since this describes very correctly what patients are feeling. And then they can rate between on a scale between 0 and 10, and they anchor it at 7. 7 means that this aversive distress is so strong that you cannot think on anything else but stopping it. And you start to dissociate some. And here, what you see is, this is the, oh yes, okay, this is not the, sorry. Here you see the correlation between the distress and the dissociative features. So that means we ask them, in addition to the level of stress, do you feel right? Do you perceive pain? Do you have optical problems? Do you have acoustic problems? Do you feel like being in your body or being outside of your body? Do you have the feeling that the time is running forward or is standing still? Stuff like that. So these are quite operationalized features from the dissociative symptom scale. And what we see here is the red line is that we have a very strong 0.9 correlation between the level of distress and the dissociative symptoms. This is in borderline patients, and this is, you also have the third thing in major depression, but they never experience more stronger arousal or stronger distress than on this scale up to 4. And we don't know how it is in healthy controls. You don't get any ethical commitment to stress them that strong that they start to dissociate in healthy people. You cannot do that. You have to have life-threatening experiments for them. So the point is, and that's important, every borderline patient, whenever, we did a lot of single analysis, so we checked about, let's say, 97 patients, we plotted out 97 patients, not one of those patients did not experience dissociative features if they were stressed. So you can say, so what? What's the problem with dissociation? There were some hints that there was some negative correlation between treatment outcome and the level of dissociation. So we thought maybe that dissociation might be a problem interfering with what we call emotional learning. Since from the very basics as a psychotherapist, as a neurobiological oriented psychotherapist, psychotherapy is nothing but emotional learning. And those variables inhibiting social learning inhibit psychotherapy progress. And for that, what we did is simple conditioning experiments. And we took borderline patients and trained them or confronted them during the learning phase with a little bit power, with a little shock, and this yellow color picture. And then they had to learn to differentiate between the yellow and the blue one. The blue one was not linked to an electric shock. And what you see here is you can take the skin conductance reduction and assess how quickly are they learning that there's a correlation between this danger signal and this picture. It's easy. And the good news is, this is the borderline patients are those, the violet group, and what we see, borderline patients learn as good as anybody else. That's the very good news. The blue ones are healthy controls. These are the borderline patients, and this is the level, the level how quickly they learn. Here's the problem: they don't learn anything, and those are borderline patients who dissociate during the experiment. And this has been replicated now 3 times. This means once you are dissociated during an experiment, you simply do not learn. And then we got into neuroimaging and did the same experiments, and what we see is that during dissociation, the amygdala are totally shot down. So this is a shutdown of the amygdala, and it's a shutdown of the hippocampus. The hippocampus is responsible for short-term memory storage. So during, if you strongly dissociate, neither your amygdala nor your hippocampus is working. That simply means there is nothing like emotional learning. There's good news for all our psychotherapists who are not that good trained in that with their patients. That means if you stress them, it doesn't make any difference what you talk with them. So you can really talk bullshit. They don't remember. But for all those of you who really say, okay, maybe it's worse that they remind what I'm talking with them and stuff and so on, it is better to help them to cool down the dissociation and block it. So the challenge number 2 is how to block dissociation during exposure. And the one thing what we thought is that we had to moderate the classic exposure-based procedures a little bit to help them to stay in reality. And the second is we have to teach them how to use strong and quick working anti-dissociative skills. And the good news is it's easy to block. Since dissociation can be blocked by strong sensory inputs. This means whenever something, and it's equals what kind of inputs. It can be pain, can be some proprioceptoric information from the feet. It can be optical information. This is where EMDR is playing with, EMDR. And it can also be noise, but it has to be very strong. And also awful taste. It has to be strong, and then the brain is reorienting in what we say external reality, and the dissociation is more or less blocked, and amygdala are activated again, so we have tested that stuff back and forth in neuroimaging, and that works. The third problem that standard PTSD treatments are confronted is how to handle dysfunctional behavior, like severe self-harm, serious self-harm, suicide attempts, and so on. There is no protocol for this. If you look at Edna Forrest protocol, there's no idea for that. And even pediatrics, good data with cognitive processing therapy, there's not a protocol for how to do what to do if patients get suicidal. So challenge we have is the first thing what we have to see, how to define inclusion criteria. When are patients ready for, let's say, adding exposure-based protocols to standard DBT? We didn't know that. And if we do that, how to provide safe conditions? What can we do then? Is it enough if we teach stress tolerance skills? Is it enough if we provide clear rules and contingency management? Is it enough and sufficient if we really have a strong and good relationships? We didn't know that. And for that, we thought, okay, I try to implement this new protocol under residential conditions. This is mainly for safety reasons. And the other thing is that we have quite good data on this DBT residential treatment. This is something you shouldn't do as a scientist. This is, I brought together all those DBT treatments which reported on the SCL90. The SCL90 in Europe is the standard instrument for the general psychiatric problems. In the States, it is not that often used. But in Europe, it's quite, everybody uses, since you can compare different treatments on that. So, and I took those, and be sure this is not one study. This is a little bit, it's nothing more than an idea you get. So this is not very scientific based. Yes? But if you look at the different treatments here, this is the time axis, and this is the SCL90. Let's say start with mentalization-based treatment. Most of you are familiar with that. Yeah? This is Anthony Bateman's treatment. This is a day treatment, and he had this treatment for 18 months here. And you see, he started with rather sick, severe patients. Here, SCL90, 2.5, it's very high. It's a self-rated instrument, so you don't have troubles with all this radars. And what you see, within the first 18 months, there's also almost nothing happening. And then they continue their treatment as an outpatient treatment, but they apply the same treatment in the group. They call it follow-up, but it's not true. It's an ongoing treatment. And then it's getting much better, and they really have good results within the next 18 months. This is the standard psychiatric care in Great Britain. So nothing happens within 36 months. Yeah, that's the problem. Okay, this is Anthony Bateman. Then, this is the Toronto group here. This is DBT versus standard psychiatric care, what they call, actually, it's a very good protocol, according to Gunderson, provided by specialists in the suicide treatment. And they're doing both, you see, they're coming down within 12 months. Here's, this is a 12-month treatment, from 2 to around 1.2 here on the general psychopathology. This is Kernberg's treatment in Germany. This is TFP. So they start at 1.5 and nothing happens. I didn't invent it. That's the data they present. That one is DBT residential treatment. That means, and this is our waitlist control. We randomized against this. We controlled it against this randomized this waitlist here. And what you see is that we get it within 4 months. As a 3 month treatment, 1 month after discharge, we assessed after discharge, and we get down to 1.2 after 3 months of treatment, and it stays stable for at least 18 months. So this is what you're currently doing. If you say on the long run, you see all treatments are more or less equal, except of TFP. But I think it counts whether it takes you 3 years or 3 months to get the same results. And for that, as I say, okay, it's at least, and it was a long start, since a lot of people thought residential treatment is harmful for borderline patients, you cannot do this, they learn how to cut themselves, and they reinforce them for dysfunctional behavior and so on. But the fact is that it's really a very sufficient and highly effective treatment, and it's rather quickly working. So for that, I say, okay, it's not non-ethical if I construct this or design this new applications under residential conditions. The advantage there is that we have a highly trained staff, we have secure conditions, and for that we can take patients even when they are cutting themselves. So we're not on that level that we said, okay, they have been get rid of cutting, but we said, okay, it doesn't matter. You can cut yourself. Come in. We work anyways. And the only prerequisite we said is that we don't want to have a life-threatening suicide attempt within the last 4 months. Life-threatening means really life-threatening, not intention, but really on the emergency room with severe medical consequences. This is what we said, we want to have 4 months after the last incident of this severity. The rest we took. The treatment is structured in three steps. We start with step one, with mainly on the functional analysis on the major avoidance and escape mechanisms. I tell you in details. We're looking what is the trauma we are focusing, and we teach them the few most important skills they do need. This means this is not a 6 months skills training, but we have only 3 weeks, where they have to learn the major skills they have to use for the exposure. And every patient, any patient, after this 3 weeks, started with the exposure-based treatment. This was the rule. First, we didn't have that rule, and then we found that we prolonged the interval till we started up to the end. Then we had this situation, it was a fixed time, 12 weeks, and often patients started at week 11 or something like that. And then I said, no. It maybe is up to us as therapists that we are afraid, that we don't dare, and there are thousands of reasons not to do it. And we said, okay, I want to really know whether we can't do it. And then we said, okay, week 4, we start. Whatever happens. And of course, in DBT, every rule is made to discuss the exceptions, but we didn't have one who wasn't ready for exposure after 4 weeks. And then, this is what we call step two or phase two. We start with what we call moderated exposure. I explain it in details. Discrimination training, daily safe monitored exposure, body therapy, and then we had, if requested, we had some treatment on nightmares. Step three is the last 3 weeks. We call it win back your life. There's a lot of training processes and a lot of things change. And this is, I learned that the major problem is not the trauma-related memories or intrusions or flashbacks. The major problem is the chronicity. And the major problem is that they adapted their life in a circumstances where the whole surrounding, family, partner, job, they are used to and to that severe PTSD. And once you change what the client, the whole field is totally irritated. And we had two dropouts in the whole thing, and this was due to the partners. The partners came in and said, I cannot stand it. Yeah, she changed that much. And we had no chance to persuade him. So, and this is what I had to learn, that this chronicity is a problem for itself. The pathways to treatment means, here's the residential program. Some of them had already had stage one treatment. It's hard to be a borderline patient and not to have DBT in Germany. So, since it's totally widespread, we have 30 units of this kind of we have designed in all over Germany, and patients go usually there. And we have troubles with our good outpatient therapists, but we have a lot of these highly specialized units. And about half of those never had DBT before. And then we had this severe behavioral discontrol interview based on the SASE developed by Marshall Linehan. This is an instrument where you can clearly operationalize the severity of dysfunctional behavior. And this is with what excluded the life-threatening suicide attempts within the last 4 months. Okay, and then after this 3 months of treatment, they went out wherever they came from. Okay. This is what we told. Serious suicide attempt, severe aggressive behavior. We said, okay, if they are so hostile that they cannot control and are attacking and something other people, we have to exclude. There was not one in our study. We had to exclude with that. Then ongoing sexual contacts to perpetrators. That was an exclusion criteria. If there's an ongoing sexual contact, not social contact, most of them had social contact, but sexual contact, then we say we don't start with the exposure. We have to focus and solve this problem first. Since it's hard to learn your brain that this problem doesn't exist any longer if you go out and then the same happens again. If this is the case, then we send them to our standard DBT program. Okay, so the background, the idea from an emotional perspective is that we say, okay, those patients who are suffering from PTSD after childhood sexual abuse, they suffer from an emotional problem, and this is emotional-based theory what we have, and what happens is that any kind of cue is activating what we call a primary emotion, and then it is strongly related and activating in a conditioned manner what we call the trauma-associated network, This means memories, rumors, cognitions, physical and body perception, and so on. And these primary emotions are not longer able or functioning to handle reality. Usually patients have learned to escape from this trauma-associated network very quickly, and they have learned to avoid, on the long run, almost any cue or most of the cues, which is really leading to a very restricted life. So this is part two. And what we have to then we have to say, what are primary emotions? These are emotions which are related to the trauma itself. This means those emotions who happened during the trauma. And this is helplessness. This is disgust, very important. This is anxiety. It's very seldom and very rarely anger, but sometimes it happens. It's often sexual arousal. It's often humiliation, threat, and confusion. This is quite important here. People don't talk about that, but there is conditioning. They often, on the long run, their own adult sexual arousal is conditioned with the activation of trauma-related pictures and stuff like that. And the problem is that sometimes they increase their sexual arousal by triggering trauma-related pictures, and they are totally ashamed of that. So we have to report that, we have to talk about that. It's physical and biological stuff, and once you have to, they are educated, I think we have about 60% of the patients have troubles with this item. Since if you are familiar with childhood sexual abuse, this is not rape. Most of the time, it's an ongoing process, and the perpetrators are often very kindly and smooth, and they work on their objects, yeah? So they are not interested in not all, yeah, on violence. And that's the problem. Sexual arousal is one of the items you have to address. And also the feeling to be something special, yeah. This is what the fathers say. Okay, you're better than your sister. You're better than your mother. I prefer you. We are close, yeah. Close relationships, and pride. And the problem is that they are in these familiar situations where they usually don't get this kind of respect or closeness or soothing, but only under sexual conditions. And this means these emotions are activated during the trauma. And they can function as internal stimuli. So if we talk the pathways to health, we have to disconnect the strong conditioning between primary emotion and trauma-associated network. So we have to rewin and regain these primary emotions to use it under reality, to handle the reality. Since you can imagine if you take all those emotions, helplessness, disgust, anxiety, anger, sexual arousal, humiliation, threat, confusion, pride, and these emotions are no longer available for you as a human being. Since whenever they are activated, you switch to this, what you call this trauma-associated network, then half of the life is a horror for you, since you need those emotions for handling daily life. Okay? So, and the point is how we do it. Basic is we trust on the data where we say, okay, exposure-based treatments are superior to simple cognitive strategies. So, but if you do it, you have to block escape behavior and you have to block the avoidance on the long run. And so you have to know what kind of escape behavior patients use. And there are different mechanisms and levels. The one is the behavioral level. Suicide attempts, Marshall had already talked about that yesterday. A suicide ideation, a suicide attempt, is escape behavior from what we hear in that case, trauma-associated emotions. Self-harm, high-risk behavior, drugs, alcohol, vomiting, promiscuity, washing and showering, about 20% have really clinically relevant OCD. So this is escape mechanism on a behavioral level that's easy to target. More complicated to target are the cognitive escape strategies, Yeah, like suicide ideations, any kind of destruction, rumination, denial, minimizing. So these are the cognitive strategies, and they are automated. They're working like this. And patients have to be aware of that. They have to learn it, that they're doing that. And on an emotion level, a dissociative state, I think dissociation is not an emotion. It's some kind of a stuck state. Yeah. And you can also say, okay, this is some kind of escape behavior. And there are a lot of secondary emotions, what Alan Frisetti yesterday reported on this term. So anger, and most important, guilt and shame. Guilt and shame can be, from an emotional theory, be described and seen as secondary emotions to escape from the awareness of helplessness, for example. So, guilt, shame, self-contempt, self-hate are secondary emotions which are activated as escape behaviors. Although that is running intrinsically and automatic, so patients have to learn that, and they have to be aware of that, and they have to know how to handle this non-justified guilt and shame. So this is more than simple exposure. You really have to block it, and you have to teach them. Principle is then, okay, what we teach the clients and say, listen, you have something like an before starting the treatment, you are shifting all the time between an avoiding state. This means I don't want to think about it. I avoid everything what is remembering me or giving me a cue, and the overwhelming state. Yeah? And they are shifting back and forth and back and forth. And what we say what we are going to reach is what we call an acceptance state. And acceptance, and that's important, does mean that we want to transform the non-controllable flooding intrusions into controllable memories. That's the point. And the establishment of a memory means that I have to accept what had happened. And this is easy to say. But most of the clients come with some kind of a magic idea that they want to get rid of the trauma. They want to get rid of their biography. They want to get rid of this memory. They want to have some kind of magic psychotherapist who transcribes or something of that, whatever he's doing. And the very point where we start is we are not magicians. What we can do is helping you, accepting you, your past, accepting you, any detail of the trauma, and to help you to accept the whole thing, and then this will become part of yourself. The story we tell is always an example, the metaphor is always, can you imagine a mother who has suffered or experienced the death of a child coming to a psychotherapist and said, please, little psychotherapist, help me to forget this child? That will never happen. Why not? Instinctively, we know this is part of our life. It's a wound. It's a scar. It will never heal totally, but we learn how to live with it. And exactly this is how we teach the clients and say you cannot run away from that. This is like this traumatic experience. It's part of your life. And for that is mindfulness is helping you and giving you the backbone for this experience. So DBT provides already everything you need for these clients, and you only have to arrange it a little bit and to ask what will be applied when and under which conditions. The heart of the whole treatment is what we call moderated exposure, and we call moderated since it's a little bit different than prolonged exposure. Since we try to reach a balance, an activated balance between what we call trauma-associated primary emotions, this is prolonged exposure, and balance it with the activation of reality contact. This means, I show you afterwards an example then, this means we push them as hard as possible into their trauma emotions, and then we take them back every, let's say, 2 minutes or something like that, and say, okay, listen, What's the difference between then and now? What are you hearing here? What are you feeling here? We ask simple for sensoric informations. We work with little power, stream, the power, for vibrations. We use different body postures and stuff like that. So the point is that due to the fact that we know that they easily start to dissociate, and we have learned from our neurobiological investigation that strong sensoric input blocks these dissociative features. And so we say, okay, maybe it helps if we induce and applicate the strong sensoric information during the exposure treatment. On a neurophysiological context, you can say this is context-dependent reuptake, the reconsolidation. Context-dependent reconsolidation. This is the experimental level underlying this technique. The whole program is designed in groups and individual training. We have they learn a lot about on the psychoeducation. Then we have the skills training, daily mindfulness. That's a big advantage in the residential groups. So we can really help them to train every day for, let's say, 20 minutes up to 30 minutes mindfulness. We have groups and we run them and everybody has to participate. So there's no escape or there's no talking about that. So everybody has to do it. Yeah, and the point with mindfulness is it starts working, let's say, if you do it in a daily way, maybe after 3 or 4 weeks. And there's no reason to believe that. I think... I don't think that whether we have data how many patients really practice mindfulness if we give them ordinary skills training under... You have data? So, but my experience was that it's better to give really to structure them that correctly. Let's say you have every day in the morning from 7 to 7:30 is mindfulness. And sports. Yeah, that's German, it's hard. And then we have cognitive interventions and formal exposure. As facultative treatments, we have discrimination training in case that they have a lot of really troubles with disgust and nightmare treatment. So, just to give you the data on that, what we've done now is we've conducted an RCT. This is our 3 months treatment. The first assessment was at discharge. The second assessment was 6 weeks after discharge. The fourth was six. Is here. The last one is 6 months follow-up, and that one is the waiting list. The waiting list is a treatment as usual wait list. Everybody has been in treatment that those time. 30% had been at inpatient wards and something like that. So this is what usually happens. It's a treatment as usual, but this is for scientific reasons important. They knew that afterwards they can enter this treatment, yeah? And this is also always a little bit weakening the data. But on the other hand, for ethical reasons, it was difficult to say, okay, you have to participate and you have to run the study half a year, and as a reinforcer, you never are allowed to visit or to join our program. It was simple, complicated to do that. For that, we decided to use a wait list. We allocated 74 patients to the trial. The diagnosis is, that's important. We had PTSD after childhood sexual abuse, only PTSD after childhood sexual abuse. So that was a clear population. And then we said, okay, they have to have at least either minimum 4 criteria of BPD, or current substance abuse, or current major depression, or current eating disorder. Why didn't we take only borderline patients? The point is that we really wanted to test whether borderline patients did better or not. And if we only take borderline patients in, we have no control and no variance. For that we said, okay, we also take patients who did not fulfill the full criteria. That gave us the opportunity to afterwards calculate whether borderline has any impact on treatment outcome. Got it? Okay. Only female. we did not take people with a lifetime diagnosis of schizophrenia into the study. We had treated now medicated schizophrenics with PTSD, no problem. If they are meds, it works. Okay. Interviews, that's standard. We skit and so on, and then the outcome, the primary outcomes is the clinically administered PTSD scale and the self-rating, the PDS, and then secondary outcomes is the BEC, the STI anxiety, the symptom checklist, SCL90, and the borderline symptom list, since we wanted to know what happens with the borderline symptoms if we only target the PTSD problems. So the sample, you see, they are quite old. In the average, they have been 36. At the average age at start of sexual abuse has been 7 to 8. So that was early. They had a median CAPS total score here about 90. This is what I already reported. So this is about a triple higher than what usually is done. In the average, they had 4 axis 1 diagnoses here. And only one additional axis 2 diagnosis, but 4-1. About half of the patients had more than 4 borderline criteria, so that was fine for our calculations. And the mean number of borderline criteria was 4.2. Patients flow. This is only for scientific. I think we have to can skip it. We did intent to treat analysis. This means everybody who started get in. We had two people who dropped out the inpatient treatment. This was what I said, due to the partner interventions. And these are the results. On the cups, this is the wait list. Nothing happens. This is the treatment group. The T2 is at discharge. And this is six weeks and 6 months follow-up. And what we find is, of course, it's a fine decrease. We have an effect size of about 1.3 between group effect size. But what you see here is, though these are highly significant results, that's fine, but they start at 90 and they come down to 60 about that. And 60 about that means this is there where other treatments start. Yeah? So that means they are not cured, but they're doing much better. Maybe that's what we can reach within 3 months. And if you look at the subsample of those who have more than 5 borderline criteria, we see exactly the same data as in the total sample. So the point is there's no influence, no impact of whether you have the full-blown criteria or less. We did the same assessments, including the borderline symptom list, which is a severity assessment, and the number of DSM-4 criteria. None of those data has any impact on the outcome. So we can be rather sure that some of the diagnosis per se or the borderline symptomatology does not impact the outcome. So that's quite good information. The next thing is for those total. For those who are in the research field on post-traumatic stress disorder, you have to be aware that most of the data are a little bit tricky, since most of the researchers report on what they call a CAPS index trauma. What is an index? Index is if you make a diagnosis and you say, okay, you had, let's say, an accident, yeah? And then they ask, do you have intrusions of that accident, do you avoid situations related to this accident, and so on. And then they say, okay, you have a PTSD related to this accident. Okay? And then they treat this, and then they say, okay, it's done, it's going better, related to this accident. This means index. Yeah? And there's not one study in the whole literature which is reporting on the total, on the effect on the total PTSD symptoms. This means, if I, and this is what you usually do, I'm taking out one trauma, let's say a rape at the age of 9, okay? And then I focus on it and I'm treating it and I'm successful. Then I can be totally successful and it's done. Then I have a total remission on PTSD, but the patient can have 10 additional problems. Yeah? And this is what you then have to do is you have to report the cups on the total. This has on the whole, on every single item. And this is usually not done in originally. It takes us 2 years to find this out. Since that was not my major game before, and I never could check it. How did they get that perfect data? And they had effect sizes of 2.7, and I never found it. And then I started to think, okay, might be that they only report about one trauma. And then I called them, and they said, of course we're reporting only about one trauma. Since we're sure that if you have one trauma, it's generalizing. And I asked them, do you have data on the generalization? They said, no, but that's sure, that's clinical wisdom. So this is how the game is played. So the point is that I think what we have to do in future is to report A, index, and B, total. And this is what we're doing here. So we are talking here about the index, you see, and here's the total. It's a little bit weaker. So the effect size on total is 1.1. On the index was 1.4. This means that those I've been calling are right. It makes sense to focus on one index trauma. There is some kind of generalization, and this is what is my experience. I tell you a little bit afterwards. So, if you're looking at the PDS, it doesn't look that nice since PDS is, let's say, remission is around one. We have the same data on the self-report, so we have significant group differences. And we have, and also there in the self-reports, no difference between the borderline patients and the non-borderline patients. If you look at the borderline symptom list, this is the severity of the borderline symptomatology. They start quite high. This is 2.2. That's high. They go down to 1.5. This is what we reach usually in our 3 month inpatient treatment. If we're only focusing not PTSD but borderlines, other stuff, yeah, that means focusing PTSD within this group of borderline patients reduces the classical borderline symptoms. This is like feeling like being alone, being different than others, suffering from isolation, suicidality, all these different items. So. And you also see this 2.2 says this is more or less the level of normal borderline patients we take for the residential treatment if you don't treat the PTSD. This means these are severe borderline patients. And if we look at the between group effect sizes on CUPS, this is the CUPS index. This is the full sample here. The green one is the group with more than 5 criteria, the red one is the group with less than 5 criteria, and you see there's absolutely no difference if you look at the effect sizes. Interesting here, the trauma related, this is what Marsha says, what you're targeting, you get it. No? So we have strong effect sizes in the PTSD related symptomatology, we have weaker effect sizes here at the BDI and the STI and so on. Response and remission. The response rate means a 30% reduction. In the CUPS, we have about 60% response rate here compared to the waitlist here. And we have about a 36% remission rate in our remission rate. This means no PTSD at all. This is not that good, as we thought. But if we look at the symptom severity at the beginning, then we have it here. This is the most recent study by Kloiter et al. This is where she starts with the CUPS at 63, and of course, if you start very low, you get better remission rates. This is where we start, and we get down here, and this is where she starts, and she gets down here. So maybe you have to continue it, the treatment. This is the back. Look at Kloiter's back. It's about 18. Is it right? Yeah. Ours start with 38, and so we get them down to 29. That's not that successful, but you see how severe they are. Safety issues, and that's important since we weren't sure whether what happens. If we really say, okay, we want to have everybody with any exception, after 4 weeks in the exposure treatment. And exposure means we're looking for the index trauma, and the index trauma is the most severe trauma they're currently remembering. This means we ask them, on your whole lifeline, what is the item where you're suffering the most? This means most flashbacks, you're avoiding any cues most, the heaviest nightmares. What is that what you don't want to talk at all, not at all about? Yeah, this is what we call the index. And so we take that one. Since we are an inpatient ward, and that okay, then we start with that one. And the idea was that once they have survived this thing, it's easier to do the rest. You can do it the other way around for a graduated exposure, but we thought, okay, we go the other way around since we tested it, the graduated exposure, and we start with the weaker one. The problem was whenever you thought about one problem, the next heavier problem appeared into your mind. And then we switched it and say, okay, then we take it. If it appears anyway, we take it. And the way how we did it is they first said, okay, sign it out. They wrote it down. Then they reported it and read it to the therapist. And then if you read it, therapist sees what are they starting, what cognitions, what idea that do they have. We said, okay, come on, read it. And what ideas come into your mind? And then they start and say, I'm wrong, I'm guilty, I've deserved that. Stuff like that. And it's okay, focus, these are your secondary thoughts, you have to be aware of those, how can we block those? So this is the preparation of all this intrapsychic escape behavior. We did it for 1 week or something. Then we started with the exposure. Exposure means in-session exposure, and then they taped all the sessions, and they had to listen to the sessions every day. The trick is, most of the time, we put them on something where I don't know the English word. It's something like a disc with a half ball below it. How do you call it? A balance board. Thank you, Melanie. A balance board. We place them on a balance board. Please, Alan. I don't have a balance board, but you can imagine Alan's on a balance board. So, the point is, if I put him on a balance board, so he starts to act like that. Why am I doing that? The point is, as long as he has troubles with his equilibrium, the brain is focusing on information coming from outside. And this is the ankles, and this is outside for the brain. Yeah. So this is sensory input from the outside. And it's impossible to dissociate as long as you have troubles with your equilibrium. And once he gets used to, and Alan gets very quickly used to, and he stands there, stop it. So he gets used to, and he talks. Then I give him balls, tiny little balls he has to catch. And once you start to catch balls on a balance board, you cannot dissociate. Yeah? So that's the one thing. Thank you. Now, let's stay here. What you do in addition is, give me your hands. We work like this. I know Americans don't touch, but sorry. We work like this. And this means if I, you have already written the trauma and your experience, and please go back. And then Alan goes back. So close your eyes. Okay. And now start telling me what happens.
How old?
Eight.
Eight. So I'm walking home from school.
Okay.
And there are a bunch of boys following me.
What? How are you dressed?
Regular school clothes, you know, pants, shirt.
What color does your shirt have?
Blue. I don't know. Maybe blue.
No, you know. Look exactly.
Green.
Okay. Yeah. What do you feel on your skin? Is it warm? Is it cold?
Warm. Sweaty.
Okay. So keep on.
and I realize that they're following me.
How do you realize that?
Because they're looking at me, and they're kind of laughing.
Okay, what do you hear exactly?
I can't say. They're kind of looking at me and laughing.
Okay.
And they're getting closer.
Okay.
At some point, I realize they're actually following me instead of just going the same way.
Okay. What are you feeling right now?
Scared.
Okay. How do you feel that? How do you notice that?
Because I have an urge to run.
Okay.
And also feeling really stupid.
Okay. Come on, listen. You feel my hand?
Yeah, but I shouldn't have gone this way. I should have taken the road instead of cutting through the woods.
Okay. Alan, stop, Shorty. You feel my hand?
Yeah.
No, you don't. Press it.
Okay.
You feel it?
Yeah.
What do you imagine?
I'm sorry?
What do you feel?
I feel pressure on your hands.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're rough, huh?
Solid, actually.
Okay, good.
That's good. No, that's nice.
Okay, this is now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
No, my hands are now. This is reality.
That actually helps.
Okay. This is now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Press it. You have power.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Go back.
Okay. So I'm walking faster.
Mm-hmm.
But they're kind of running
mm-hmm.
towards me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really scared.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of look back, but I fall down because.
Okay.
I looked over my shoulder to see what they were doing. And they were all kind of mobbing around me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really scared.
Mm-hmm. You feel my hand?
Yeah.
Press it. This is reality. This is now. Okay? How old are you now?
Now?
Yeah.
51.
How do you mention that?
Huh?
You're grown up, huh?
Yeah.
How do you know that?
I thought about my birth date and I subtracted.
Okay, this is thinking. What's the difference between there and now? How do you feel it?
I'm not scared here.
Yeah, that's a feeling, but give me information. What's the difference? What would have been the hand of an 8-year-old boy?
Smaller.
Okay, press it now.
Okay.
Got it?
Not so small, right?
How tall are you?
5'8", 5'9". Yeah.
Look at me.
Yeah.
You see me?
How
big would I be, how tall would I be if you would have been 8 years? Go in this position. You see the difference? So come up.
Yeah, that's pretty different.
Okay, you see that?
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
I have an 8-year-old.
Okay. Okay, keep on. Okay, that's it. Yeah. This is how we do it.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. So this is not a severe trauma, but this is more or less exactly how we do. We push them really forward. This is go in the presence, go into their native language, exactly reactivate the smells and anything. And whenever they're really in, we take them out again and say, okay, what's reality? Yeah. And this touching is, I don't know whether it's really necessary. The fact is that everybody says, okay, that's fine for me. The one thing is that you really, it's easy to have him, to guide him, yeah? So the patient is not alone, and you really can, whenever he starts drifting away, you simply can press and say, you feel my hands, yeah? And they start, okay, there is something. And the second thing I think that's important, no data on that, clinical impression is, this is the all this shame-related issues. Most of the patients are shamed to death, since they think, when I report, my therapist has something like a scenery, a picture, the whole scene in his brain, and he sees how awful it is. And the action tendency of shame is hiding, that's clear. What happens is that I have them in my hands, and they feel okay, he's not disgusted, he's not embarrassed or something like that, but he still holds me. There's no talking about that. I think this is a body-related information which is very important to correct all this shame-related gene. We don't talk about that, yeah? But I think it's very important information, which is so implicit running, maybe. Edna says we have to test it on the scientific way. Edna is right. I really don't know whether all that stuff we're doing is necessary. What is now? This is the power problem.
Is that what happened yesterday?
Yep.
Okay.
There was something wrong with this.
Okay. Okay, and now it's running now. It's good. 5 minutes. So, okay. So we've been talking doesn't matter, we have 5 minutes anyway. So, you look at this is the safety data. Side effects. You have it on your handouts, huh? If you look, every dot is a scatter plot. Every dot is one patient, huh? And this is the relation between the cups at intake and the cups at discharge. And so all those clients who changed nothing are within this field of the non-statistical changes, and the red ones are the wait lists. And all those who are up to there, they get worse during the treatment. All those who are here get better during the treatment. You see not one dot in the left wing here. This means not one patient get worse during the treatment. This means, and here you see about 50% didn't improve. That is the case. But I think this is, if you look in details at most of the psychiatric treatments, even in successful depression treatments, that's how it is. We can reach about half of our clients and the other half not. And I don't know who responds and who not, and we don't have predictors. But this is how the data are. So this group really takes benefit, and this information is that it doesn't harm at all. The next question is, what's up with self-harm? 23 of our subjects were engaged in self-harm before admission. At the first week, this was reduced to 7. This is simply due to the fact that we teach them some skills and so on. And what we said is we don't want to have an increase in self-harm. Whenever self-harm appeared, we gave them the traditional protocols. They have to have BAs. Try to use skills next time. So we were very close to that process, and of course self-harm is an escape behavior, and we don't want to have escape behavior, but that's no reason to not start with the prolonged exposure now. So this is what the line is. And if you look at the individual subjects, then you see this is the frequency of self-harm behavior during the treatment, that almost anybody really came down within the first week and stayed there. There's one who took a little bit longer, but came down also. And this is the second group here. So we didn't have an increase in self-harm. So you can say this is due to the nurses and due to contingency manager. They didn't dare or they didn't report. Next thing was urge for self-harm. You can assess the urge for self-harm. And there we say, okay, interesting. It doesn't go down, but it doesn't go up. So urge for self-harm simply stays during the treatment. And here starts exposure all the time. Yeah? So there's no increase in urge for self-harm. And the same is true for suicidal ideation. So of course they have suicidal ideation. That's what they have all the time. And if you wait till it's done, you can wait forever. So also here, we had not one increase in suicidal ideation. Not one. Yeah. Okay, that's it. I could now go into details on the treatment, but I think we take 2 or 3 minutes for discussion. What we have, I think, what we could show is that it's a safe and quite effective treatment. DBT provides everything you need. If you are targeting PTSD in the severe disabled population, and the only limit is that we have only tested it under inpatient conditions, and we have to test it now under outpatient conditions. The advantage is that we now know that it's safe, and I'm sure Melanie is exactly reporting the next step, or the step she developed in parallel. We do more or less the same, and she has already started to conduct the data on an outpatient level.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah. Questions? Okay. She asked whether we have data on the return in the hospitals. You're talking about this treatment or the usual DBT, standard DBT treatment? On standard DBT. The point is we have in the average. In Germany, there's an average 60 days a year emergency attrition. No, not attrition, I'd say. Admission. Yeah. After this treatment, this comes down to about 8 days in the average a year in the following years. So this is quite helpful. But there are a lot of confounds. The point is when you get a DBT therapist and you have a group and a skills group for, and you can continue the whole treatment, you have a big advantage. And if you don't have and you have troubles in your job and your partner, you have problems with relapses, of course. All the data show that the relapse rates are quite high. If you look at the last Sanarini study, published 2010, she reported things she didn't report at the first time. They have, even in the remitted patients, they have, let's say, they have about 80% remission rates. Remission means 2 years within 10 years. This doesn't mean stable remission. And in this group, 40% have a relapse. So that means only about 50% have really a sustained non-relapsing remission. These are the data of Mary Sanarini. And they are not better. Huh? You're shaking your head? Sure. And these are the data. We have the same problems in Germany. It strongly depends whether you get a sufficient treatment or not. Yeah.
Specifically, interested
in the severity of their borderline personality pathology. Yeah. 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 The point is, what we looked for, of course, is the borderline severity, the self-harm, the suicidality. This has no impact. So, and we didn't find any predictors till now. I don't know. I simply don't know. Maybe it's a special German situation. We have a quite good healthcare system, and we have a lot of patients. Huh? It's different, and we have a lot of patients who are. They have been traumatized severely, but then they decided to live with this as chronic patients, and to go from one clinic to the next clinic to the next clinic, and it's a specific. Yeah, task, challenge to work with those group and say, okay, what shouldn't change and what should change and what you're afraid of changing and what could happen if you are very successful. So we start now exactly with that question and say, okay, listen, we have good data, and the most complicated thing is that we have very good data, and the most complicated thing is that maybe you are totally healed. And please tell us what shouldn't change at all, so that we don't make the mistake and change too much. So, and then they start to think exactly on this chronification process and think, okay, what are the benefits I have? And this is, I think that's the number one problem, the benefits. Listen, they are 36 years, so this means a lot of them are 50, and in their 50s. And just getting a treatment that works after 40 years of suffering is horrible. Since they really say, okay, well, I didn't get it that earlier. And it's quite quickly working, so you really can look at that it works. And this is a disaster for them on their whole biography. So you have secondary problems. They are more important than the primary problems. But this is a second challenge we have to work with. Yeah?
Children. And I was
Yeah, of course. The problem is you cannot have, you never can look whether, you can do no causal attributions. You only can look at correlations, or you look at animal research. There you can have causal experiments. And in animal research clearly says that physical stress, what abuse is, early separation stress or something like that, has morphological impacts. You have the HPA axis is different, the prefrontal maturation is different, the hippocampal volume is different, and so on. So, of course, you have troubles with that. But on the other hand, we thought this would be true for PTSD, and then we did the sibling studies, and we found that the siblings had the same thing as well. So we don't know whether in human subjects what is the cause and what is the symptom. Yes, we are not sure. He asked about the skills training. What we've developed is a self-help CD. This means emotion here. We have developed a self-help CD. So, and we give this self-help CD to the clients before they are admitted to the unit, and they work with that. So they have all the theoretical stuff of the skills they have already learned. We make tests then and so on. And then we can focus only on what we say, the three or four important stress tolerance skills, how to cope with dissociation. And then we focus on emotions. We teach them all about guilt and about shame and about self-contempt. So this is the focus, major focus. So that's that much. Yeah. Jo? Sorry, please repeat.
Okay, so what we struggle with when someone does self-injure, even though we do behavior analysis, things like that, the medical response, the nursing response is very reinforcing. They go and they give care. And
yeah, but okay, she's asking how to handle the non-intended reinforcing of the nurses after self-injury. Oh, our nurses are trained. So they are DBT nurses, so everybody knows that any consequence has an impact. Oh no, they are quite cool. So they have they taper themselves, and there's nothing good attention and stuff like that. They do their own care, and sometimes if they have to go to surgery, then two of them go. So the point is, this is the standard inpatient DBT protocol. This, once you have cut yourself, you have a timeout of 2 hours, you go into your room and you write your BA, and then you take all your peers and you report your BA to the peers, and you discuss what could be done next and how to repair all that stuff. So this is an ongoing protocol that's standardized. So for that, it's quite clear they don't like it, and there's no, at least not much, non-intended reinforcement. Yeah. Charlie Swenson has developed that. This was not me. Huh? Time. Yeah, it's time for Melanie. Thank you.